which that will be he and I are loosely working next year at Alcon on doing a Constantine meets Alan Moore reproduction
that was born on this very show.
Yeah, where I'm dressed as Constantine, he's dressed as Alan Moore.
he'll bring his like little Lulu comic.
Yeah. All right, here we go. You ready?
All right, I'm fine.
Cole,
ready to roll.
Ladies and gentlemen, what can I say? Welcome to Hey Kids Comics. This is issue 137, the fifth in a five-issue story arc on Alan Moore. I am Andrew Farmer. With me is Cole Houston,
the shallow husk that's right.
Of a man.
The shale.
Right.
Of my former self.
The intelligence fract. Like, they just went, they just busted
it's
the...
It's like a brain and a skin at this point.
Really?
There's not much else left. The rest was completely devoured.
Gelatinous bones thing. So, yes, you with us tonight, we've had a guest on every issue in this Alan Moore story arc, and with us tonight, this is no exception, is a brilliant, wonderful, beautiful woman that we have.
Aww.
That's true. Shut up. It's true. I've had a pleasure to meet this year. Cole's known for quite a while longer, and that's Diane Tran has joined us.
Hello.
There she is.
Hello.
Woo.
Thank you very much.
So, what have we talked about so far, Cole, in this story arc?
We have gone. We started out light. we had sort of the appetizer, if you will.
Let's not break this down to a five. That's a weird thing to do with Alan Moore, is break this into a five-course meal. Like,
that's right. Yeah, what's odd is we followed our robot episode.
Because they would end with us eating our waiter. That's the fifth issue.
But, you know, way back in number 133, we just sort of started out with the general overview of his
work. Yeah, yeah.
By 134, we were talking about... It was literally our Jumping the Pond episode. This, we went from the British stuff, the early stuff, to him making a huge splash and pretty much taking over American comics.
Yeah.
We then moved into the legendary status that both fandom and Moore himself have built around
the man, the myth,
the man, the myth, the beard, and finally,
it's legendary all on its own. It really is.
Yes, and in our penultimate episode, used correctly, we entered into the relationship that Alan Moore has with anyone trying to adapt his work to the silver screen.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the varying levels of hatred or indifference or anything else that might serve the legend of Alan Moore.
And I think, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm going to say I think Alan Moore's pretty angry with us right now. Because the thing you've got to realize about Alan Moore is that he's a practicing witch. Okay?
Yeah,
and this is our...
A witch!
This is our potpourri of doom episode of Alan Moore. There's going to be a lot jammed in here. So I'm going to start... This is sort of like a Larry Wilmore's grab bag. I'm going to start with Alan Moore's a witch. And it has, since we have started this story arc, Cole, I don't know if you've realized this or not, since we have started this story arc, it has rained nonstop in Dallas.
You know, I had not thought about that.
Yeah.
Yes, it has been, perhaps it's like that thing in Free Enterprise, where it's like the lathe of heaven reference, where, you know, you get pissed off, it rains.
Right.
We've had about 15 tornado warnings, so it's Austin and Houston are completely flooded.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. So. Apparently, I went down to Austin, Catherine and I, for like a day and a half, and returned home to find out Austin was now flooding.
Yeah.
And we're like, okay, that was, and when we were there, it was beautiful and sunny. So.
Now, here's something I didn't know, is that all of this came... Now, in 1993, he announced that he was he was dedicating his life to becoming what he called a ceremonial magician.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And this all came from a line that he wrote in From Hell.
So that means that you can't, like, hire him for parties.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Only for dignitary functionality.
That, oh, I see.
No, but a line that he wrote in From Hell is where this came from. So in a lot of ways, he's looking at this situation much, I think, like he looked at, quote-unquote, meeting Constantine. Here's another piece of the legend that he created. So he wrote a line in a book that made him realize that he's a magician, and that line is, the one place gods inarguably exist is in the human mind. So from that, he extrapolated that he was going to become a create a shamanistic lifestyle for himself. That's where it came from. So here's my question. So that was, you know, 20-odd years ago now.
Yes.
What does that mean for a writer of the caliber of Alan Moore to become a, quote-unquote, ceremonial magician, a shaman? How does he view himself? Because this is all coming from him. It's not like somebody walked up to him and tapped him and said, you know, you're the secret shaman that has been passed down.
I don't know. He's not Iron Fist. Could have said that. Could have imparted that to him.
Yeah, but he would have told the world. If John Constantine told him that, he would have been on AOL and every mush chat board, whatever they had in 93, telling...
MySpace.
Right.
Talking to his characters, and his voices in his head. So,
But what does that say about his art? You know, that's the way he views... Because he says that magic is an art like writing. And
I think certainly that you can... There's literally... I mean, there has to be something intrinsically wrong with you to become an author.
Right, in general.
On a certain level, you know, you have to be enough skewed from the mainstream just to write. Creative people, it's in our nature.
Right.
To be outside the norm. And when you reach the level that Moore has... I think there's a point where the art and the artist, you know, you literally don't know where one begins and the other ends, or vice versa, and they each begin to inform each other. And if you're not careful, you can sort of spiral into this world of your own creation. And I think that these are Alan Moore's worlds. He's sort of creating his own reality, because that's what you do as an author.
So speaking of what you just referenced, his conceptual magic shaman place, his spirit walk, his walkabout, if you will, is in a place that he refers to as the idea space, which is accessible by anyone. It is the place where all ideas are formed, essentially, and where all religions and magic come from.
It's kind of like that thing in Speed Racer where he entered the dimension born of speed.
Right. Yeah. It's the speed force. It's the dimension born of speed.
This one is the sort of a slower dimension that's born of writing.
It's where Beetlejuice comes from.
It's one of these places where you just sort of wander in, and if you're lucky, it washes over you. And occasionally you'll hit the doldrums.
Right.
It's writer's block.
And he says it, you know, he says it just works, it's Alan Moore. Here's the thing, right? This lends validity to what Alan Moore is saying in my mind, because Alan Moore will spend an entire book, you know, explaining that Mogo doesn't socialize. But when all he can say about the idea space shamanistic magical pursuits that he has is that they just work.
It's just this thing, you know.
It's just a thing. Like, okay. But no, he and also let's discuss the Glycon, by the way. Did anybody stumble upon Glycon?
No, I don't.
Glycon is his primary deity. It's an ancient Roman snake god.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
Right.
As far as you know.
Right, as far as you know. It's Glycon. That's
okay. I thought that Glycon was that stuff they used in Windex.
Yeah. Right?
Which is why it's, you know, maybe one of those cleanliness is next to godliness type of things. That's why they put Glycon in there.
So, what do we think about this? Like, how does it inform... How does it inform his writing? How does it inform what he does that he believes? I mean, he really believes it. Regardless of what you believe doesn't matter, okay? What you believe to be, what truths you hold to be self-evident don't mean crap to Alan Moore. What does it mean that he believes that he's a ceremonial magician or a shaman or a, you know, or has a bag of tin spirits or whatever he thinks he has, like, how does that inform his writing? Is like you know, what does that mean?
Are you talking to me? Or
anyone. Right. Open door.
We're going to give you the floor, though.
Yes.
Well, the thing is that I know several witches, actually.
Okay, okay.
This worked out well. Yeah,
yes, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, be honest, I had no idea going in that,
that you knew witches.
Yeah, well, I have a friend who's a druist.
Okay.
I have a couple of friends who are witches. One who got out of Wiccan to get out of there because she was in a cult at one point.
Wow.
So,
all right.
So I've heard kind of like the bad stuff and the good stuff. Now, me personally, I don't judge him for a great deal of what he believes in, because I can't judge anybody on whatever they believe in. But the thing is this, whatever it is, whatever your spiritual faiths or your philosophies are, they are deeply ingrained and they're very personal to you. So no matter what, they're always going to be a part of you, and they always inflect part of the, particularly your creative process. And that's just him. Maybe that makes him more creative. I don't know, but that is just who he is. I have a feeling that just reading through his work, he has thought about this for years. I'm talking like decades. So the fact that he publicly said it, he probably has been practicing for at least 15 years before he even said anything. So, or at least he's been flirting with it for that long. So I can't, the Wiccans that I know, it's a very personal experience, a very private experience, because it's different for each individual. Some of them go for a more feminine route, some go for a very masculine route. Some do it in a very equalist way. Some worship goddesses, some worship suns, moons. It kind of depends. My friend, as a Druid, goes through Irish, more of the Irish route.
I'd go through a lot of Irish whiskey, so I can understand.
Yeah, but the thing is that, but then you also have to go that Druidism has been extinct for so long. And she even explained to me that it's all developed back in the 70s, and most of it that came through the hippie movement, and so a lot of that is completely BS. It's bullshit. Can I cuss here?
Sure. Absolutely. Please.
Okay.
Shit. Yes, okay. You can.
A lot of it is bullshit that was created in the 70s, but the thing is that was 60s and the 70s, so it was a lot of free love, it was a lot of peace, it was a lot of individualism, it was a lot of going against like the man and all that. That doesn't mean it's bad. So it spoke to people, and brought them certain sense of belonging and individuality, and they found themselves.
One, for the most part, no one's trying to burn them at the stake either.
No, right. No, I'm not trying to do that. But the thing is that I'm.
But no one was. That was the, why. Much easier.
I'm not
centuries later.
No, Diane, what he's saying is that centuries later, it's much easier to do that because nobody's hunting you. You can actually express yourself in such a way. You know, that was not happening.
No, that's not happening. But then again, we're in Texas, so...
Well, that's true. Valid point. Okay.
We're in Texas, so I'm a Buddhist, actually, and, you know, I get a lot of guff for just being that. So
I'm a skinny white male, and I get guff for being that in Texas. I don't know.
So for me, that's just like, I kind of don't have much of a comment on him as a witch, as a magician. I guess it's just easier for him to say magician rather than witch. But technically, it's a unisex term.
But here's my thing about that, right? If you know Alan Moore, as we've kind of gotten to know him in the last 5 weeks, and we've known him before that...
Yeah, we have the benefit of having delved deeply.
Not only is he a brilliant writer,
yeah,
right? But he's also, at his very core, he is, probably the world's greatest carnival barker. I think he's a brilliant huckster.
That is true.
I think that he is the P.T. Barnum of our time, and we just don't know it yet. Like, I think we'll look back on his work and say that, you know, like with nothing but respect, but say that he's, you know, this is what he did. Like,
and in many ways, it was rather what we got onto in the legend episode,
right.
Was that he... How much of it is him creating the legend? How much of it is other people creating the legend? And what he's willing to embrace
So my thing is, I'm not saying in any way that he doesn't believe this is true, and that it's not a highly personal thing for him, yeah. right? But he is in this weird kind of social anxiety, like super ego kind of way, able to take what is very personal to him mm-hmm. and make it an affair to remember, make it a circus for everybody else to enjoy, because I think in a lot of ways that makes it easier for him to personalize it if it's sort of in the theater of the bizarre out mm-hmm. in front of everybody. So what part of this is, okay, let's say he's a Wiccan or practices paganism in his personal spare time, but needs to present it as ceremonial magicianism to everyone else to make it, to again, increase his legend.
And also in a way that personalizes it. Because
right.
he is coining a term that is uniquely Alan Moore.
Right, right. And also to say something like, I worship Glycod, the ancient Roman snake god. Like, but who, by the way, he goes on to say that people say that he's a complete hoax, by the way.
Yeah.
And he is quoted, and I'm going to read a quote, okay. that the very fact that Glycon is probably one big hoax was enough to convince me to devote, or no, somebody else wrote this, Ethan Doyle White says, the very fact that Glycon was probably a big hoax was enough to convince Moore to devote himself to the Scaly Lord, for as Moore maintains, imagination is just as real as reality. Exactly. Exactly.
So I think what it is Alan Moore actually knows that song that gets you into Imagination Land from South mm-hmm. Park.
Ah, yeah. He's Willy Wonka. Alan Moore is Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And Matt Fraction got the golden ticket. And he's just, he's right now he's in Wonka Land learning about Glycon and getting rapey.
Yeah, with the Grunkalunkas.
The Grunkalunkas.
Tell them I hate them. But I think, though, that it really is. It helps to drive the legend. It creates, Moore is nothing if not provocative.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And to create a provocative personal space, at least the personal space that you're allowed to, that you allow the general public access to, then it creates this person. And in a way, it serves his writing, because then you can read this stuff and say, well, obviously Glycon was involved. And lots of it.
Take with lots of Glycon.
That's right. He takes more than the recommended daily dose of Glycon.
And that's the interesting...
Well, actually, also, he will be a guest at Glycon this year.
Oh, nice. Good. The ancient Roman snake god convention.
GlyconCon.
GlyconCon. GlyconCon XXV. It's 15. It's GlyconCon. But it's weird that it's an interesting thing for me that he takes these parts of himself, and I think it makes it easier for him to if he takes his personal beliefs, whether it's the fact that he's a socialist and an anarchist and all of that, or whether it's that he's a ceremonial magician and he practices shamanism and polytheism, and then he blows them up larger than life and then releases that monster into the public, much like Watchmen, then he can sit back and be himself while his legend grows and people talk about stuff that isn't true, stuff that might be over-aggrandized, while he can do what he wants to do.
And I think that also in sort of presenting himself as this kind of a magician, it is, in a way, admitting, if you're shrewd, you're going to realize what he's telling you is it's all smoke and mirrors.
Right, yeah. Right.
And if you're not paying attention, you're not catching the fact that he's giving himself up.
Right.
And I have to agree with that, because I also have an interest in... old magicians. I mean, the fox of performance magic. And if you look at just like old posters and everything, like Keller and Thurston, Houdini, all that, they're making pacts with the devil. They're
right.
dancing with imps.
Right.
So
it's
really just like they're dancing with imps and they're beating the devil at cards, things like that. So
or
really, that, so they're advertising themselves as maybe like devil worshippers, or they're, they beat the devil and things like that. And most likely, you know what? I can see Alan Moore completely say it's a hoax.
Right,
probably is.
He's a showman, whether he likes it or not.
Yeah, and he is, which is so strange for someone as elusive and as he is.
But is he? I mean, that's the whole point of this arc, is like, is he really elusive? You know, is he really this you know, this introvert that hides out in his, you know,
is that a little cave?
Yeah, in his shire.
Yeah, is he like the hermits from Monty Python, yeah. Or is he really more? Is that a pretense that he's putting out? Because the thing about it is, if you make yourself that strange,
right?
Yeah.
Then, in a way, you become approachably unapproachable.
Yeah.
In that you can. You know, people feel like they know you, but yet they're not 100% certain. So they're really not sure what to make of you. It's like, I know you, but I don't understand you.
Well, and he's extremely popular in overseas, in Great Britain. He's extremely popular, way more popular than it is here. We know him because he's a brilliant comic book writer and author. I mean, that's why we know him. You know, and Watchmen helped. I don't think it made him a household name. But more people knew who he was because of Watchmen and V for Vendetta and, you know, the movies that he put out than before. But still, it's still niche. The niche is larger, but it's still niche.
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, because of what he does, you know, when he writes to the newspapers, and then has it, you know, he's made himself into a public pop culture gadfly of sorts over
basically, so it kind of goes like, is he a hermit, is he elusive, or is he the showman that he's putting on a pretext? And my answer is pretty much yes, both.
Yeah, are there two Alan Moores? Because I feel like he's an entire part of his life that's the egress, you know? Like P.T. Barnum's egress, there's an entire part of his life where if you know the story, P.T. Barnum needed to move more people through the tent, so he invented the egress. The egress is, I think, is Latin? Is it Latin?
I believe it is, yes.
I believe it
yes,
is
okay.
Latin,
it's Latin for, you know,
exit.
Basically exit. So he had all these signs, and he was telling people, this way to the egress, and people loved it, and they were going to the egress, and they went through the door to the egress. Egress means exit. They were outside. More people moved through the tent. Everybody's happy, and P.T. Barnum did it this way. I really believe that all of this is his egress. It's his way of moving people through his life
and
becoming more popular.
In that one episode where it's almost like a sleight of mind
versus
sleight of hand. And the other purpose that it serves is it allows you to have this larger-than-life character, more so than almost anyone, or I would dare say anyone in comics. In a way, Stan Lee did what he did because he was a showman.
Right. Oh, yeah.
He was able to give you the most ridiculous stuff. But he would go out there with such enthusiasm and sell you the stupidest concepts.
Right.
What Moore is doing is exactly, in many ways, the same thing.
Right.
Only with high concept art.
Right.
And he's selling it in the same bombastic way. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, at the end of the day, they're both these great showmen who are giving you this stuff, and you go and you eat it up and you go through the egress, as you were saying. And what that allows him to do is be the person who brings you, Mogo Doesn't Socialize, or some of the other things that he's written for DC that were
Swamp Thing,
very approachable. And then also at
Vigilante.
The same time, give you arcs in Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
That were just like, young.
Yeah,
and concepts that just, you know, you're like, I feel like I just watched Tusk or Velvet or and yet, you know, as horrendous as the concepts are, they're at once, and that's rather what we're getting at with this particular chapter, when you gaze into the abyss, is that it's a compelling place. It's that train wreck. It's that desire to stare the worst and the most horrible things. It's the horror movie, the thrill ride, the Grand Guignol.
Yes.
Because, you know, what's funny to me is that the more horrible, you know, when horror movies went from monsters and shock to ordeals and blood and guts.
Right.
Myself included, a lot of people were like, oh my God, this is just the end of days, you know, and I wouldn't go so far as say the end of days myself, but you know, people perceive that, oh, this is the, you know, humanity has dropped to this level. But over 100 years ago, one of the most popular theater attractions, like in proper, not movie theaters, but, you know, acting theaters, live theater, was the Grand Guignol in Paris.
Right.
And the Grand Guignol was on stage like Hostel. It's like if you did Hostel as a stage play.
Right.
Or Jigsaw, or not Jigsaw, Saw.
Saw, yeah.
If you did Saw as a stage play, that's what they were doing 150 years ago in Paris on stage, you know, nightly with a matinee.
Well, the thing, you know, the funny thing about that, and I laugh about it, this is off topic a little bit, but I laugh about this because, you know, everybody talks about the Saw movies and the, you know, and all of the what they call torture porn films at this point.
Saw wasn't that bad.
No, it wasn't. No, most of them aren't, when you get down to it, that bad. But they talk about it being a departure from what horror it means, what horror is. And apparently, they didn't bother to read, you know, any Edgar Allan Poe. You know, read The Pit and the Pendulum? Did you happen to read The Mask of Red Death? Did you read Telltale Heart? Did you read any of these things? Because, you know, there's so many of them that are all about, you know, this walling somebody up so they'll die.
The diabolical madman and the fascination with the slow death of your enemies.
Right. So, but that's a departure from what we're talking about. But
in a way, that's...
Well, then again, you can go back to, like, the Hammer Horror
classic. Can we?
And they rebooted all these old Universal monster films, and they added blood and sex to it. So,
can we talk about Kronos, the Vampire Slayer? It's my favorite.
And then they're saying, like, oh, it's rated X and blah, blah, blah. This is a departure from the original monsters. And well, now they're classics, so...
There should be. They should be. And by the way,
the
it's Christopher Lee's
birthday.
Hammer
being in England, they were rated X because of the blood, not because of the sex.
Yeah, right.
Which, it's strange. Strange thing.
I love me some Hammer movies.
I love it. I love the Hammer film.
So while we're talking about rated X, I think it's time that we have to. We've waited.
We have stood on the edge of the abyss. Mm-hmm.
Now 4.5 hours
we've
waited.
It's time to throw the ropes over the edge and start to...
Trigger warning. This is about to get weird, so prepare yourself for the...
Now, this is where I really wanted Diane to be on this show.
Right.
Because Diane is a convention goer.
I am.
And she is, like, at every local convention. So you can pretty much count on finding her there. So I spot her at one of the conventions in the Dallas area a few months back. And I'm wandering over to say hi. And I am picking up the conversation that she's having with somebody. And it became what I would describe as a conversation about the rapey side of Alan Moore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I realized that, you know, if we ever had a chance, this needs to be it. That could be a topic all itself for this show. And as it worked out, when we, you know, went from let's do a show about Alan Moore to let's do a whole arc, I said, you know, we've got to get Diane on the part where we just delve into Alan Moore's unflinching mirror of society. Because as much as we'd like to think that we've overcome the beast within, we're reminded all the time that it still exists. It is a more ingrained part of human nature than civilization in many ways.
Well, and the question is, why is it... Because literally, and I'm not going to speak in absolutes.
Yeah, because we talked about that on the very first episode of the show, mister.
Virtually every major work that he's ever done has had some form of sexual violence in it. Leave Extraordinary Gentlemen did, we know Watchmen did, we know V for Vendetta did, we know Killing Joke had, you know, violence that could be perceived as sexual, whether it was directly sexual or not. Miracle Man did,
Tom Strong did.
Tom Strong did.
Necronomicon
has.
Did.
Yeah.
Lost Girls.
I think with Necronomicon, you would be, and Lost Girls both, you would be disappointed if it didn't.
Yeah. Right. There, you're going to
Alan
it.
Moore, and that far in, you're half expecting it. But
yeah. Right.
Swamp Thing did.
Yeah.
You could say Superman did.
Yeah.
So, and,
I'm trying to recall if Top 10 had anything.
You know, it's so bad to say this, but given the evidence, I would think it would have to.
Yeah. I mean,
given the evidence, it's generally so.
So why? Why? Because he has... Okay, so he has go-tos, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. Like he goes to social injustice.
Yeah.
That's one of his go-tos. He goes to religion a lot. He goes to, you know, and he goes to sexual violence. Does, I understand if you're going to use it in, to frame a particular character, like the comedian.
Yeah.
Or like, yeah. Or like the Invisible Man. Or like Hyde. Like, I get those characters. Like, I get the framing. If you're going to do it once and be like, this is the only time I'm going to do it in my career to show how awful this is, to really put an accent mark.
For example, the Major Force.
I don't agree with it, but I get it.
Like, okay, like the Major Force thing where...
Right.
What's her name? A fridge.
Yeah, the girlfriend in a fridge phenomenon.
Yeah, that thing. But that was a...
Kyle Rayner.
Yep.
Yeah.
Kyle Rayner.
But that was a one-off. The thing about it is,
Major
that was
Force
not
did it,
career-defining.
Right.
That author didn't go on to cram people in fridges for the rest of his career.
Yeah.
But yet,
in fact, he kind of got a lot of flack over that.
Yeah. But what's odd is, why does Alan Moore not get flack over being so rapey?
I think he...
Because of that legendary status?
I think he does, and you just don't hear about it because he doesn't care what you
that's
think.
That's true.
And that does kind of go... partly towards that, and plus the amount of it, to say like, oh yes, Watchmen head rape, but the thing is that how many times does it happen? It actually happens quite a bit.
Yeah.
And even though to League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, every book of the League has it.
Right.
So and it's not just once, it's,
you know, I'm gonna go out. You know, this is the safe limb, right? This is the limb that's firmly attached to the tree. This is the safest position I've ever taken on this show. I don't agree with Alan Moore for using rape as a motivation plot for his books.
It's not only a motivation plot, but it's a plot point. It is simply like, this is what this is.
Like, this guy is bad, so he rapes.
Okay.
This guy needs.
I'm gonna go out. I'm gonna actually walk out on. You know, and he's straddling the limb.
Okay.
At the point that it
meets the tree,
the
right?
Yeah, you're there back there. I'm going to walk out onto this limb.
Oh, are you
daring?
Okay.
I'm going to be a little controversial here, and I'm going to say that by and large, I'm not going to say exclusively, but by and large, it seems like rape is the sole tool in his toolkit to upon which the amorality of a character
agreed.
Is hung.
Agreed.
This is the nail in the wall upon which he hangs amorality. So it seems like that's the trigger, that's the reason that this is the rape scene becomes the metaphor for amorality. It almost becomes like the go-to, like almost sort of a Victorian idea of things, like this particular thing comes with this.
I agree with that. I mean, I agree with that in that sense for him.
It's like, okay, if you put the rape cloak on, you're obviously the amoral character.
Basically, but when you went into the conversation with that, basically I had a conversation with one of the sellers and a con guest, and we went into our favorite writers. And he said, Alan Moore, and I kind of went, I don't know. Because you go like, yes, I agree. He is a wonderful writer. He is a very excellent writer. But the thing is that he goes, and I went, how many times does rape come up in every one of his stories? And then he had to look, think for a second and go, oh,
yeah
you know, I never thought of that.
That was my point.
And then you came by and I went, And I knew you before, obviously. And I said, you're an Alan Moore fan, you tell me. And I just posted that question. You just kind of came in out of blue. I felt so bad putting you on the spot like that. But then you started thinking.
Because the thing about it is that unlike most people, you can mm-hmm. pose that question to me on something that I'm very intimately familiar with, and immediately in my mind's eye, mm-hmm. I am looking at every single mm-hmm. piece of Alan Moore's work that I've ever encountered. And I'm suddenly seeing a spotlight shone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was always there, but it just suddenly, like someone had gone with a highlighter. Oh, by the way, here, you know, for your Cliff's notes, here's the rape scene. Mm-hmm. This one.
There's the rape scene in this one.
Yeah.
And it's not.
It's like
not
a Where's Waldo, almost. No, like, not to downplay it, but you can. I can go back through my lexicon, my brain, you know, my brain library.
But it becomes one of those things, like, if somebody, if you're watching a show, like, oh, here's some bloopers you may not have noticed in these films.
Right.
And then for the rest of your life, you are waiting for that blooper to arrive.
Yeah.
And is there anything wrong with that? No, but what it does is it changes. It was at that moment everything changed, because suddenly I am looking for the rape.
Yeah.
That I hadn't really, I mean, it was there, but I hadn't really registered its prevalence, because each piece was being digested as a separate entity.
Does it keep him, does that keep him from being a legendary writer? What will he be remembered for? You know what I mean? Like, because the thing is, if Alan Moore does it, it makes it acceptable for everyone else to do it, because everybody wants to be. We've talked about this. You either want to, you either want Alan Moore to hate you, or you want to be Alan Moore. That's sort of the way it works. Does it keep him out of the ranks of being a legendary writer? Will he be remembered for the Swamp Thing books, or will he be remembered for this?
Here's the thing. I think that these are the reasons why he kind of got his fame. Because there are at the time when he started coming out, and he started making a big splash, he's kind of the person who started it. And I'm thinking about, like, going through the Bronze Age, going to the Modern Age, and one of the big things that kind of comes up, he goes, it's the rape, it's the violence, it's the sex. And you could say, yes, it's blood, it's the guts, it's the beating of the fisticuffs. Well, the fisticuffs have always been there. They just added a little blood. And but the thing is that it's the subjects that he kind of puts up, the amount of... The thing is that it's different. It's such a different violation compared to being beaten compared to being raped. And
yeah,
that is a line. That's
example,
a huge line.
A good example of that occurs in Miracle Man.
Mm-hmm.
When you're given the history of Emil Gargunza.
Mm-hmm.
And he's speaking of, at the age of 14, having outsmarted this local gangster, having, you know, kind of cooked the books under his nose, and to the point where he owned all of the gangster's men,
mm-hmm.
and revenged himself on this guy by raping his woman and then beating the gangster to death.
Yeah.
And you have in that one story the juxtaposition of the physical, the sexual assault, and then the physical, violent, in this case, deadly assault, where you have those side by side. And that, more than anything, underscores exactly what you're talking about, Diane, because
mm-hmm.
in a way, what is illustrated is a shot of the young Gargunza, you know, mid-violent swing with the bat, the spray of blood. The rest is implicit. But he later, in the same narrative, speaks of having killed a man, as he puts it, I killed a man before I had a man's hair.
Yeah.
And so you're imagining, you know, here's a kid who apparently, by his own admission, hadn't even gone through puberty, raping a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, Moore is, number one, illustrating that rape isn't, you know, the big misnomer, I think, with rape is that it's sexual, but it's more about assault.
No, it's about... No, every...
But I mean, it's not the...
Let me say it. Anyone who says that rape is about sex is wrong. Anyone who says that...
Right. Oh,
now,
yeah.
Rape, no matter what it is, is power. It's power over the individual. It is power over... You have complete and utter control about if they live or if they die, basically.
Yeah.
But it just happens to be that... You have not only control over their mind, you have control over their body, and really, you have a control over their life, essence. And no matter what happens at the end of it, they're going to change, whether they're going to live or die. So
you also
it's an absolute violation
Yeah.
Of being a human being.
And in a way, though, that it sort of gives you both of these types of assault.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the same bit of the same narrative, yet downplays, in a way, the worst of the two. You know, him beating the other guy to death is intrinsically, in many ways, not nearly as bad as the fate of the otherwise inconsequential character that only appears as part of that story. So,
and that's kind of my thing with the Miracle Man, is that she is basically raped for the mere fact that she associates with the other person. That's the only reason. Now, if you had changed that, how different would it have been if he had raped the gang member, like the actual guy, the man, so rather than the woman? And maybe he would have kept the woman as a comfort woman. But then again, that's just as bad, because then he would systematically rape her.
Effectively, would be that same kind of ownership, as it were.
The ownership, yeah. And there's also one thing that I wanted to talk to you about when we did get on this subject, is going into League of Extraordinary Gentlemen with the rape of Nemo's daughter, and it's completely pointless. Absolutely pointless.
Well,
because
is that in
it's in a later book. It's okay. What happened is that Captain Nemo's daughter basically disagrees with her father's philosophy.
1901, wasn't that
I think it was. I want to say it's Black Dosser.
Yes.
Okay. I want to say it's Black Dossier. And basically she completely disagrees with his philosophy. She wanted to do something completely opposite, and then she gets gang raped. I mean, and it's graphic.
Yeah.
It's graphic how she was gang raped, and then she converts into her father's philosophy just by that event. And you're just going
she was more passive. Father.
But the thing is that she's a secondary character, but wasn't needed.
Was not a secondary character. She was definitely prominent.
She was prominent in that, but then compared to her father, she's kind of secondary to him, which is kind of sad with a lot of women in Alan Moore's universe. A lot of the women are secondary.
Well, that was, I think for Alan Moore, what that was, now for the rest of us, it doesn't work this way, but for Alan Moore, it was his way of showing her the real ways of the world. Because she had not lived in, you know, she was sort of kept by her father, wasn't necessarily exposed, so she decided that she wasn't going to subscribe to her father's ethos.
But here's the kicker, though. Do you think it was planned
by Alan Moore that way?
No. Do you think it was planned by the father?
No, and according to the book, I don't. Maybe it was. It's been a while, but but speaking strictly from Alan Moore's motivations as a writer, because again, you know, his well when it comes to this subject is pretty shallow. He reaches in and pulls it out. Well, I need to show the reader, this is the way I'm going to have her see the real nasty, gritty way of the world, you know. The same way we see it with the same way we see it with Silk Spectre and Watchmen, to some degree, not wholly, but to some degree, you know. This is another one of his go-to moves, which is kind of, at this point in his career, disgusting for me. I mean, I'm sorry, but he's a brilliant writer. He has so many mechanisms to fall back on that we've seen him use.
Yeah. The thing about it is, I think that what we're realizing here is the best writers all have a go-to mechanism. I mean, I absolutely loved reading Michael Crichton's work. Most of it was amazing. But there was one underlying theme, and that was the sort of devil in the details.
Well, it's that something goes wrong when something's not supposed to go wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Look, it's always the little devil in the details, that little thing that no one could ever think of.
Right.
Yeah. That is an inevitability. But in the same way, I mean,
It's chaos.
Do I fall? Yeah, exactly.
It's chaos.
But do I
life finds a way,
before,
Diane. Life
I think
finds
he was illustrating
way.
Chaos theory before even chaos theory had been formulated.
Andromeda strain, and yeah.
If you go back to like the Andromeda strain and stuff like that, where just a little piece of paper can nearly, you know,
in
the world. But the thing about it is, unfortunately for Moore, it turns out that his go-to is a wildly bad idea go-to.
Right.
But intrinsically, it's no different than the devil in the details or other certain little things that crop up routinely in authors' works. And that's rather why I came to the conclusion that that's his...
Yeah.
For the most part, his... that sort of illustration of the amorality of characters, which is very heavily... it serves a purpose with the comedian in that you see at an early age... I mean, is it the best way to illustrate this? Probably not. Mm. But if it can serve a purpose, the purpose that it does serve is that even in his youth, you see the beginnings of the, I don't give a shit about anything.
Right.
To the point where, you know, by the time he is in Vietnam and it's just, I mean, he's at home. And I think you see that Dr. Manhattan begins to recognize this, that this is the world that was made for this man. But in the case of, say, in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen 2, again, we're going right back into rape and amorality, but Mr. Hyde, that particular rape scene is this righteous indignation, this delivery of... the most horrendous punishment for the most terrible of treason,
right?
That can be imagined. And you know, the thing about it is that, as I said earlier, sometimes Moore's brilliance blinds you to some of the rough edges or giant crevices that are there. Because I was so blinded by how brilliantly the post-rape was portrayed.
That the actual
blood begins to appear, and you know, he realizes, oh, he must have died because now his blood's visible everywhere.
Yeah,
and it was such a conceptually that was brilliant. Again, the vehicle through which that's delivered, up until the point where it was pointed out that there's so much that's such a recurring theme.
Yeah, it is a recurring thing.
That I was lost to that fact.
But I'm not sure if that's kind of like a gender thing. Not saying that rape is a gender thing, it's not. But
no,
the thing is that it's very prevalent as a female reader, and I see it probably far more times than guys tend to see it. So when I read them, I can't help but get a completely different perspective on that for that reason, because I understand that the comedian is a very bad person and he did this. So I get that. But the thing is that he had been doing all these bad things for a while, and then for some reason that is the kicker, and that's basically, it's an instant lazy way to say you're bad. So and it is.
And also in a way with Sally it does.
Ideally, the
concept there was that, you know, here is this person, as Dr. Manhattan realizes, someone that Sally Jupiter should have hated.
Yeah.
But yet somehow turned to, that perhaps, at least there's some implicit moment that perhaps, you know, after getting the crap beat out of him by Hooded Justice, there may have been a moment where, you know, somewhere between the Minutemen and Vietnam, where he, for the briefest moment, was a decent guy.
All right. I'm putting a pin. I'm putting a pin in the rape. I've had enough rape.
No. You can't say that. No. You can't say that. Because I'm going to give you some more examples, okay?
All right.
We opened a can of worms here.
Yeah, we did.
You can't just put and describe only a few of them. There's a lot of them that are out there. How about the pedophilia of Alan Moore? And this happens actually quite a bit. You have it in Watchmen, the little girl who is raped by the pedophile and then chopped up and then fed to dogs. You had the Gollywog from, I believe it was Black Dossier, and who is basically, if you don't know what a Gollywog is, this is a very British, a little cloth rag doll, like a little raggedy hand, but it's actually a racist depiction of a minstrel, a black minstrel.
Oh, yeah, it was a Piccadilly type.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a Piccadilly kind of type. The thing is that I kind of secretly kind of want one, but
well, it's not a secret anymore.
Well, the thing is that I love the history behind it, and I understand that it is racist, but I also, I have a small collection of racist comics and films that I collect, and simply because that is part of our history, we should not deny that it's there, but we should know that we should know better. So,
oh no, exactly. In fact, I saw a thing years ago about an African American history professor who was actively collecting memorabilia from. I mean, I was amazed to see how blatant that sort of thing was in this country. The point, there was a restaurant that was, I mean, you know, I remember as a kid going to a restaurant called Sambo's.
Yeah.
And that disappeared.
Yeah.
With the peace movement. But there was apparently still worse stuff.
Yeah, there were far, far worse things. And the Yellow Peril kind of things, the Asian stuff is also just as bad.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's mostly the stuff I collect for the mere fact that I am Asian. So, but the thing is that you have the Gollywog who is who is part of children's stories, and he's made into this pedophile who is trying to basically a predator of small children who are under 12. So,
or Holly Griffin Gentleman at the Girls' School, too. It's just, they could have put that anywhere, but.
Yeah, but I remember you going into quite detail over that in that conversation back in the North Texas Comic-Con about like how he's invisible, but he's at a girls' kind of orphanage, all girls thing, and they end up magically pregnant, but he is in fact raping all these young women that they don't know.
And Alan Moore does. Alan Moore uses pedophilia. He uses rape. He uses murder. He uses the X. You know, whatever X is. The nth degree to show you how bad a person is. That's his way. But he also does the opposite to show you how good a person is. For instance, the Watchmen, you know, the self-sacrifice of going after Ozymandias, the childbirth scenes in Miracle Man, Swamp Thing.
Here's the thing. It is to say that rape is a shorthand for saying that a character is evil. No matter what, you will have an opposite effect of that, and you'll get a generic, like a character. I mean, it could be a very generic character, and all of a sudden they become the White Knight.
Right. Well, you always.
And it's always kind of like you have the opposite effect happen. You had it with Barbara. Whether she was raped or not, it's very blatant to me, but some people I've had hours of conversation and people telling me it's not, but Batman becomes the White Knight, and then you have characters Hollis Night Owl becoming the White Knight,
but then again
Hooded Justice himself, there is some questioning things about what he did to little boys, but that depends on which version you read.
That's another plot turn it's a device that he uses to establish who is the really good guy, who is the really bad guy. Can we move the story forward? Can we use this as the turn? You know, all those things are there, and he uses not only, but he uses, you know, any of the most awful human atrocities you could possibly find to do those things. I don't know if it's misguided or brave that he's willing to do it, and in the ways that he's willing to do it. But my question remains: does this keep him from being a legendary writer?
I think that I can't help but go like, well, he's repetitive, and he's certainly
he's pedantic. That is a pedantic thing.
Yeah. It is a pedantic thing, and you can't help but go like, oh my god, he's a genius, and I'm going, I can't say he's as great as some people laud him into being, because he does that. But then again, I will do that to anyone who would be pedantic over
small. But like, everyone is Michael pedantic.
Yeah, everyone is like that. Everyone kind of has.
But I also, though, at the end of the day, is this what defines his work, his body of work, or is it the sheer genius of giving us things like the character of Joe Pye in Top Ten,
or right,
the brilliantly orchestrated murder of Ozymandias's assistants, where you don't even realize that that's happened until it's too late. Things like that, where you the subtle layers of this wonderful Abigail Arcane rising above her ancestry,
right.
And becoming probably one of the single strongest characters I've ever seen in comics, because she's constantly thrown into a position where she should be written by anyone else. She'd be curling up in a ball and playing the "Oh save me" thing. and anyways, I found Abigail Arcane to be a stronger character than Lois Lane under any writer.
Oh yeah.
Because, quite frankly, Lois Lane never had a relative come back from the dead and drag her to hell.
So, right, that's true.
But the thing about it is, at the end of the day, we spoke earlier, this rather works out rather well as kind of taking things full circle, about that very personal experience of being a Wiccan or a witch or a, performing, or a ceremonial
magician.
That the takeaway of Alan Moore as either the most brilliant or the most repetitive and pedantic and annoyingly fascinated by rape scenes author is going to be ultimately a personal experience. For Diane, for yourself, I know that you're finding many a detractor in that.
Yeah.
Because did, from your own personal point of view, you're beginning to recognize things that other people from their perspective aren't really catching. And that was one of the things that fascinated me about having stumbled on this conversation, is that got me thinking.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, one of the things we like to do when we're not doing fart jokes on this show
is engage.
To try to engage people. And
we're like 75% fart jokes. All right,
yeah,
we're like 75%.
Really, you lucked out on this one.
We're like 75% fart, 10% dick,
and
15% engage. Absolutely. Because everybody's, I don't think it makes, it's my show, I'm going to say it. I don't think it makes him less legendary. I think Cole's right. I think you're both right. I think that it's a poor choice of a vehicle. I do. I think that all of that is a poor choice of vehicle, but does that make him less legendary? No, because this conversation is happening.
That's true. And when he passes, he will become a much bigger thing, and we will still have this conversation.
He won't. He's not going to pass. He's not going to... that was one of the questions we posed at a very early issue.
Go Thor, or whoever will come down from the heavens and garner
Glycon,
him.
Glycon, the Quetzalcoatl, Mazda.
Yeah, the craggy realm of the Mastrothos.
But we were talking about that. I think that's the thing, is that, will this conversation ever be over, about Alan Moore? And I don't think it ever will, and I think this is as much a part of it as anything else is. I think this is the baby on the staircase during Battleship Potankin of our you know, people will continue.
Potankin?
This is Potankin, like, Mandy. Mandy Potankin.
Was this Eisenstein's Mandy Potankin?
It's Mandy Potankin's one-man show. It's called Battleship Potankin. Shut up, Cold. Shut up. But no, I think it's the Rosebud. I think it's, you know, the Citizen Kane of comics. I think that we'll continue to have this conversation about what it means, about, you know, who he is, what he meant, and what he continues to mean for, I think, probably as long as we're going to have it about Jack Kirby, or as long as we're going to have it about...
I think that you will have your Mount Rushmore is Lee and Kirby, and then Alan Moore, and... to be named.
I'm gonna say it. It's Jim. It's
Lee would be there, I guess.
It was Lee and Kirby are the beginning, and then Alan Moore, and then I'm gonna say it. It's Jim Shooter. Like it or not,
damn,
it or leave it, Jim Shooter. It's what it is. He had a bigger impact on the comic community.
I have to say that yes. As far as
Ditko, oh well, that's true. Steve Ditko. It could be Jim Stranko too. We might have to have a really big mountain.
Ditko.
Yeah,
Ditko.
I think we should have like a big, just like a big, like carve out half of the Grand Canyon.
That's right.
With comic luminaries like John Byrne or.
Yeah, you have to Byrne. You'd have to have. You're gonna have to have DeMatteo in there. You gotta have.
Coach and Jock.
Jock will be on one side, right? Mobius, Barry Windsor Smith.
We have a fondness for Jock on this
question.
Show. Yeah?
I think Stranko is the only one you need.
One. So,
All right. All right, I'm wrapping this up. It's time. The hour's up.
Yeah, we better... The thing about it is, Diane, that the having never been on the show, you're not accustomed to what 136 episodes in already behind us, plus two annuals. There is never enough time.
No. Which means you'll be invited
back.
Right
now you're feeling like, I could go on for 3 hours. Trust me, we could go on for 3 hours.
But I make sure the trains run on time around here.
We could too, trust me.
And we will. And we will. But for the time being, we have to stop.
Cutting out. Can you still hear me?
I can hear you. You sound good. So, Diane, do you have any...
You guys are cutting out.
Okay. Are you gonna have to leave us? Just hang on.
You guys are kind of like corrupting. So
well, of course we are. Of course, that's what
we
do.
We're very corrupting.
All right, Cole, will you start by plugging us up, please?
All right, we are coming to you, of course, through the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com, home of this and many another podcast. You can find our sister versions of the Jedi Cole universe over at deepelemonair.com.
Right.
Where we have some live shows that occur out of Dallas, Texas. And you can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. We would love to hear from you about this particular subject or anything we've talked about. And speaking of conventions,
those are things that happen.
Yeah,
here.
That's a thing we're steeped
in. Oh, it's coming
here.
Up this weekend.
There's a lot of them.
That's right. Yeah, there's another convention this weekend as we speak. Fan Days and Fan Expo rather in Dallas, but you can find out about that and listings of every convention in the Lone Star State at Convention Awareness Project Texas at www.cap-tx.info.
There you go. Diane, do you have any plugs? Do you have anything you want to plug that you're doing?
For those who are, I guess, interested to contact me, I'm actually on Facebook at Tranimation, which is TR Animation. And you'll find me there. You'll also find me at DeviantArt at Tranimation-, not underscore, but dash, art.
Get your damn underscores out of here.
And I'd like to say thank you for inviting me.
No, thank you for coming.
Yes.
And if you go out, Diane does a fantastic Rocket Raccoon out there. So if you're if you're in the Dallas area and you go to the Fan Day, what is it this weekend? What's
Fan
the name?
Expo.
Is it Fan Expo?
It's, this weekend, Friday through Sunday. So.
There you go. And you see a Rocket Raccoon. It's probably her. She's probably talking about Alan Moore.
Uniform.
Okay, just wanted to point out, if you see an orange Rocket Raccoon, ignore that person.
If you see an actual Rocket Raccoon, it's probably Rabbit. It wouldn't be that close to people. Please.
Yeah, it's probably not. If you see a naked Rocket Raccoon that's actual size, it's probably a real raccoon, and best to avoid
it. Most likely Rabbit. It's really thirsty but scared of water right now. Just go away from it. All right, guys, next week.
And I'll be giving out stickers.
Yeah, she's giving out stickers. Giving out them stickers. So join us next week. We're going to talk about the most wholesome of topics.
We are going to go to the other side of the coin. We are going to go to the, as Guy Gardner put it, Captain Whitebread himself.
That's right.
We're going to talk about the original
Captain Marvel.
A.K.A. Shazam, A.K.A. Billy Batson's alter ego, A.K.A. what Miracle Man was based on.
There you go. So join us next week for that. And with that, buy, collect, and enjoy your comics, especially Alan Moore stuff. It's going to elicit a response in you one way or another, and that's what art is supposed to do. So regardless of your feelings, go read Alan Moore. It's awesome. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
And thank you, Cole.
Thank you.
And say goodnight, because this is the... I want to say goodnight for like 3 days straight now since we just finished 5 issues on Alan.
I know. This has been an amazing arc. So we are going to bid farewell
to Alan Moore for a while. Yeah. All right, guys. So say goodnight.
Goodnight, everybody.